You're listening to Season 2, Episode 15 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, storytellers! Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Vermont College of Fine Arts for sponsoring today's episode. Their MFA writing program has been around for 35 years. At the end of the show, you'll find out why they're ranked one of the best low residency writing programs in the country. I am so thrilled to have number one internationally best-selling author Karen Slaughter on the show today. Karen is one of the world's most popular and acclaimed storytellers, with over 32 million copies sold around the world. Karen's newest book called Pretty Girls was just released this week. A quick overview about her book so you can follow along during our interview. Pretty Girls is a psychological thriller that uncovers a buried history of dangerous secrets, cold vengeance, and forbidden truths. Two estranged sisters must come together to search for the horrifying details about two tragedies that devastated their bond and even their attempts to lead separate lives. In today's episode, we unpack Karen's thought processes and technicalities behind her newest book, Pretty Girls. We talk about how she transitioned from Renaissance poetry to writing crime novels, and we discuss why it's so important for writers to define what success means to them. For listeners who are currently working on novels, pay special attention to Karen's advice about character development and her honest thoughts about writing workshops. By the way, today's episode is the very first one I recorded on the phone rather than the usual Skype calls. So just a heads up, the sound quality may sound a little different, but the content is still just as awesome as ever. Now let's jump right into the episode.
What's one thing that's really exciting you about your work right now?
Well, you know, I think it's a great time to be a woman in thriller writing. We've had a lot of successes with psychological thrillers, and as a reader, I'm just really pleased that so many people are tackling these subjects.
How did you first fall in love with writing?
I've always been a really big reader. You know, I wrote my first book when I was 6 years old. It's always been something that I love doing, and I've always been the kid who had a book in her hands and needed glasses at an early age. Something that I've always felt passionately about.
Did you already take classes in high school and college knowing that you want to be a writer?
Well, in high school, not particularly. I mean, I was in English classes, and I was fortunate enough to have some very good English teachers. In college, I studied Renaissance poetry. That was really my passion. And then when I was told I had to take something other than English classes, I dropped out. So I was a few quarters away from graduating, so that didn't make my father very happy. But I think one of the things for me was it had just being in college had convinced me that the thing that an English degree would be really good for is teaching English, and I was much more wanting to write my own kinds of stories and really just sit down and concentrate on being a writer instead of talking about being a writer.
I'm fascinated that you mentioned Renaissance poetry. How did that come about?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, it was a very coded language people had to use back then. It was a volatile time. Our artists and writers had to depend on patrons, and they couldn't be too political, so they had to find ways to talk about politics so that other people couldn't really understand what they were doing, and that's what a thriller is all about, is hiding things in plain sight.
How are you inspired to write about the topic that is brought up in your book?
Well, basically, the book opens and a bad thing has already happened. 25 years ago, there were three daughters, Julia and Lydia and Claire. Claire was the youngest and Julia was the oldest. And Julia was 18 years old and she just disappeared. They lived in a college town. Julia was going to college and she just vanished. And the family had no idea what had happened to her. The local police wasn't much help, and they don't know if she is alive or dead, if she ran away, if she was abducted, if she just met a guy and joined a hippie commune or anything like that. They just have no idea, and that mystery of what happened to her is something that tore that family apart all those years ago. And so when we catch up with the remaining sisters, Claire and Lydia, 24 years later, they're estranged. They've both kind of gone to their most base levels to some degree because of losing their sister. And it was an opportunity for me to talk about how crime changes people, changes communities, changes families, and just can shatter them apart.
Was any of the plot inspired by a true story?
Well, part of it was inspired by being with someone who talks to me, who works with the FBI, and he's a guy who never wants to be thanked in the back of the book because he's just kind of guy. But he does a lot of stuff, financial crimes, a lot of stuff to do with the Internet. And this is something that he mentioned to me when I was talking to him about a different book about the sex trade because, of course, Atlanta is the busiest passenger airport in the entire world. And so we have a lot of bodies coming through here. If a kid is kidnapped in California by a stranger abduction, they generally end up at the Atlanta airport before they're moved on somewhere to Europe. So you know, I was talking to him about that phenomenon, and he mentioned this other thing, and I thought, well, I'd like to write a book where that comes into play.
Do you ever feel overwhelmed by all the research and all the news that you're reading to pull inspiration from?
To some degree, I read a hell of a lot of crime fiction, so I'm kind of anesthetized to the shocking things in a certain way.
That does help.
Yeah, that does help. But also, you know, this is my job, too, and I read these things as part of my vocation. And I talk to a lot of police officers, medical examiners, lawyers, all those types of people who are involved in really horrible things happening. So, you know, stories like what I talk about in Pretty Girls, they don't necessarily shock me. I mean, certainly I feel really upset that this kind of thing continually happens. I mean, I'm not writing about anything that's a new phenomenon. I mean, if you turn on the news right now, you could probably anywhere in the country find thousands of women have disappeared, hundreds of thousands, millions over the years have women have just disappeared. You know, until the age of 45, if you look at the top five reasons women die from infancy to the age of 45, always within the top five is homicide. It's the number one reason women who are pregnant die is homicide. So, you know, I'm not talking about anything that's not out there, but, I mean, it does get a little depressing to think about all the awful things that are done to women.
If it comes to a point where you feel it gets very depressing, do you take a break? Do you stop what you're writing and take a few months off? Is there anything like that so that your soul doesn't break, almost, I guess you could say?
Not really, because I think even when I'm writing about something dark in a book, I always balance it with some sort of lightness, and I think that's important for people who are writing just in general to remember. You always have to have a good balance between lightness and dark, no matter what kind of story you're writing. And so even if I have a particularly difficult scene, you know, the next scene might be a more emotional scene where there's a connection. And that's the thing about any crime, really, is that connection to people. And we all know, I mean, God, not to compare anything I'm writing about to 9/11, but everyone I know on 9/11, when they heard about it, the first thing they wanted to do was to be with their family and friends.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, going back and using that as a touchstone in the book where there's some recovery with the family, where Claire and Lydia's mother is there, and, you know, you have the letters also interspersed throughout the story from the father who has passed away before the book starts, but he's writing letters to his missing daughter, and that really gives the heart of the book. So I think if you do write about dark things, you have to have a lot of other things going on, because just unrelenting darkness is not the kind of book that I want to read. I want to feel the character's humanity. I want to feel their reaction to the story, and I want to have some sense that there are such a thing as survival.
How do you create your characters?
No writer, whether it's Mark Twain or Faulkner or Eudora Welty or anyone, is capable of just creating a wholly unusual, different character. You know, there are always going to be elements from their own life that they've integrated into that character. And for me, I definitely am conscious when I'm doing that. Sometimes I'm not conscious when I'm doing it, and I'll think, wow, that character does the same thing that my dad does. You know, what I try to do is to make them not superheroes. I think, you know, especially when you're starting out and you're writing your first book, the issue of control is very important. You know, you want everybody to love this character, and you want people to hate this character, and you want, so there's a tendency to over-explain or over-import good qualities or qualities that you think are good into one character or qualities you think are bad into another, when the fact is people in the real life are generally a blend of good and bad. I mean, there's no such thing as a perfect person, and there's no such thing as a wholly bad person or a wholly good person. So with Claire and Lydia and the father, I thought about who I wanted to tell this story, and I wanted Claire to be someone specifically, since she opens the book and so much of the story rests on her experience. I wanted her to be a very complicated woman, and I think she is. You know, we learn very early on that she was arrested for a little act of violence, and I thought that was an interesting thing to give her, you know, to make her kind of prickly, the sort of woman who's really beautiful, and if you're just a regular woman, you look at her and you hate her instantly because she's really beautiful and she's thin and she's athletic and she has this wealthy husband and her life is perfect, and you think she's going to be a certain type, but in fact you find out she's quite a different one.
How's your writing process like with your characters? How are you able to keep it succinct so that we can see that growth in their characters?
Well, it's not very defined. I mean, I don't write out on note cards or anything like that. But I do think very carefully about what you just talked about. Is the character of Claire that you meet in the first chapter believable as the Claire that you meet in the last chapter? And that's something I pay close attention to when I'm finished with the book and I go back and read it from beginning to end. I want to make sure that the voice carries through, especially if you're not writing a series. If you're doing a standalone, you have to make sure that the characters' voices are very distinct to themselves. I think it's important that you be able to pick up any page in the book and say, okay, well, this is Claire's voice. This is Lydia's voice. I really get their distinct differences. And one of the key ways for that, for me as just a shorthand, is, you know, if you think about Claire's life and Lydia's life, it's separated in a vast, vast way by money. And Claire's thinking is totally shaped by the fact that she will never want for anything. She's never wanted really for anything. She's always been taken care of. She's always had a seemingly easy life where she can go wherever she wants, buy whatever she wants. She gets in trouble. Her husband buys her way out of it. You know, her life has been very charmed on the surface. And Lydia's life has been quite a struggle. She was a single mother. She was homeless for a while. She had a drug addiction. She really had to struggle to write her life and make a conscious choice to get clean and to take care of herself and her child. So, I mean, those are very different experiences. And I think, you know, even if Lydia won the lottery and had a gazillion dollars, the fact that she has known those struggles would inform her for the rest of her life. And so that was a good way for me to key into who these characters were and how they looked at the world.
I know you said that you don't have, like, an actual specific way of writing with, like, note cards or whatnot, but do you outline? Is that something that helps you with your writing?
Pretty Girls, structure-wise, was not that complicated. I do quite a bit of thinking about my books before I start writing them and about different sections. And so when I was thinking about the overall structure of Pretty Girls and thinking about the father's letters, I really thought that I would write the story and then go back and write the father's letters and put them in there, which is not really how I write. Normally I write chronologically, so the first page you read is the first page I wrote. But I found that I needed the beat of those letters because they take a little departure. If you notice with a critical eye where they're placed in the story, they're sort of like these cool-down moments when you've gotten to the bottom of the roller coaster hill and you're about to go up to another one. That's where the father's letters really play out. And, you know, slowly you start to realize, oh, wait, he's actually giving us some clues to what happened. So, you know, I really need to pay attention to what he's saying. And that, to me, was something that had to be written in time with the book. I couldn't do it afterward. And that's generally how I do things. You know, I think of the book in sections, and I really am very focused as a writer. So I block out 2 or 3 weeks at a time. I have a cabin in North Georgia. I go up there, and I sit down, and I write every day until I can't write anymore, and then I go to sleep, and then I wake up the next day and write again. And that's, again, how it was with Pretty Girls. You know, I didn't have an overall outline per se. There have been past books, especially when I've messed with chronology. Like, I did a book called Unseen recently where some of the chapters are told in reverse chronology. So I had to make sure that everything lined up so that when the chapters got to, like, what happened, what started all this, it wasn't the middle of the book, it was the end of the book, so it made sense. For Pretty Girls, it was more of like a natural flow of the story just coming out of me.
So how long was the overall time of writing your book from research to all the way to the finish of the last page?
With Pretty Girls, it was very quick. I was in the middle of writing another book, actually. And
oh.
I had this idea for Pretty Girls, and I called my editor and I said, look, I want to write this book instead. And she said, I think that's great. If you're excited about it, do it. And, you know, we'll figure out the timing. And it worked out really well timing-wise. I think it took me about 12 weeks, soup to nuts, to physically write it. Of course, it took months of
what?
Thinking about it. And, yeah. I write very quickly. I do generally.
Jeez, you are so badass. That's so awesome.
Well, I can do about 20 or 30 pages a day if I'm going at a good clip.
What?
But I think about it a lot, you know. I write mostly in my head. So by the time I sit down, it's like more like taking dictation.
I'm pretty sure most of my listeners right now have their jaw open. So thanks a lot for making us feel so immortal.
Well, but, you know, a lot of writers don't do that. Like Charlene Harris, I think she's 6 pages a day and she's happy with that. Or Laura Lippman, I think, writes 4 hours a day. Or, you know, it just really it's however it works for you. But mine comes from when I was first started writing, trying to get published, I did not want to be a starving artist, and I had a full-time job. I actually owned my own business. And so I had to write. I had to get up early to write before work, and then after work I came home and wrote, and then on the weekends I wrote. So I'm used to these very intense bursts where I don't have a lot of time and I have to be very focused. And that's served me over the years.
Wow. Would you mind me asking, what was the business that you owned?
I had a sign company.
A sign company?
Yes.
Like
yeah.
Selling
lighted
signs?
Lighted signs, banners, point of purchase.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
When you were selling the signs, you knew that you wanted to get into specifically crime writing, right?
Mm-hmm. I always loved crime, and I love crime novels, and that's what I read. I love true crime. Ann Rule was one of my favorite authors ever. And, you know, I read Stranger Beside Me and In Cold Blood, and that's the kind of book that I really loved. I didn't think that's the kind of writer I could be, and so I tried for years to write historical fiction or, you know, The Next Gone with the Wind, and actually that's what I got my agent on, is a book that was historical fiction, and she loved it, and she shopped it around, and no one wanted it. And, you know, I was crushed. Then I talked to my agent, and she said, well, what do you want to do next? Because I love your writing. I think you're a great writer. Tell me the story you want to work on next. And I said, well, I've always wanted to write a thriller, but I don't think I'd be able to. And she said, well, give it a try, and if it's good, then send it to me. If it's not, then write something else, because you're going to be a published writer one day. You just have to find your right story. And so that's when I wrote my first book that was published, Blindsided. I remember I was really just everything opened up when I decided that's what I wanted to do. It was a big revelation for me. And just writing the basic bones of Blindsided, I had 17 days. That's all the time I could take off from work. And I wrote the book in 17 days, the bones of it. And then, you know, I went back and added to it and edited it and all that stuff you have to do. But I do remember that feeling of just exhilaration, like I had finally found something that I loved and I was passionate about.
Oh, I have a smile on my face. I wish you could see it. I'm just like, oh, that feeling, it sounds amazing. When you were talking about how you were feeling crushed, when that historical novel, it didn't go through, is there a moment in your career that you can remember where you really felt like you were stuck in a rut and you didn't think you could get out of it? And how were you able to get out of that moment?
Well, you know, I think I was just stupid and arrogant, because I got a ton of rejections from agents, a ton, because I had decided, when I first started out, vanity publishing was really not something you did. And self-publishing, I mean, I think it's gotten a better reputation now, but it was just the worst thing you could do. You would never get a quote-unquote real publisher if you did that. So I knew I had to get an agent. And so I got a writer's market that listed all the agents who were and what they were looking for and all that, and just did submission after submission. And I really did feel depressed about it because I kept getting rejected so much. But I also thought, well, it's not me, it's them. You know, they're not. This isn't what they're looking for, or this isn't what they think they can sell. And I think that's important to remember, too, is that, you know, an agent may love what you're doing, love your writing, but think, I've sold five other books exactly like this, and I can't sell this one, or nobody's looking for this kind of story right now, or, you know, they always are looking at it with an eye on the market, mm-hmm. because that's how they make a living, and I don't fault them for that, because people have to make a living. That's how I looked at it, is I just thought it was going to happen for me eventually. I just had to get the right story at the right time with the right people, and eventually that lined up. But, you know, if I knew then what I know now, I probably would have given up, because it's impossible. I mean, if you think about just being on the New York Times list, which I've been very fortunate enough to do, I mean, that's an impossible goal. How could that even happen? You know, there are 52 weeks in the year. There are 10 slots each time. What are the odds that of the 250,000 people who get a book published every year that you'll be one of those 500 or so people who end up on the list? I mean, the odds are astronomical. So if I had really known what I was doing, I probably would not have thought I would be able to be successful in writing.
I'd love to know, what was your proudest moment in your career?
Well, you know, I think it's always nice when you are nominated by your peers for an award.
Oh, and yeah, for sure.
That's really meaningful. Or readers, you know. I've been nominated by the Romantic Times readers for some awards, and
wow.
That's very meaningful to writers. You know, even if you sell a bazillion books, it still means something. Everybody wants to have recognition from their peers. But, you know, I think about the fact that my first People magazine review, which was a really awful one. They totally hated my book, my first book. So the first time I had ever seen a really bad review was in People magazine, and I was standing in the store reading it, and I got a call that my book had, that at that same time, debuted on the New York Times list. And I thought,
wow.
You need to remember this, because this is such hot and cold of what can happen with your career. And it's a lesson in not listening to some of these reviews that can be awful, and kind of just paying attention to what success is, you know? And I think especially
yeah.
for a woman, it's kind of hard to say, I'd like to be successful, because it sounds like a horrible thing for a woman to say. I think it's important to define what successful means for you. Is it that you have a lot of readers? Is it that you get good reviews? Is it that you get published at all? Is it that you are delighted by telling your story still? I mean, there are all different levels of success. I mean, if you think about Emily Dickinson, I mean, she consciously chose not to publish in her lifetime, but she felt very close to what she was writing, and she was very thrilled with what she was writing, and she, you know, she would be successful in her opinion, you know. So I think that a lot of people need to decide when they try to become published writers, what does success look like for me? I mean, just getting published, my God, that's a huge hurdle. Not a lot of people can say they have a book published, so you know, that's what I always think about is, you know, what is successful for me? I think pretty much it's just I get to tell the stories I want to tell.
Do you ever struggle to find ideas or story ideas, or it's always coming at you?
You know, I've been very fortunate that usually when I'm writing a book, I'm thinking of an idea for the next one or the next two. And that's kind of the usual writer's curse. I always want to be working on the next book, not the one I'm working on now, until I get to that next book. But, you know, it's not really the story that's the hard part. It's figuring out how to implement the story and how the characters will express the story. I mean, honestly, if you ask me what my books are about, at a very basic level, they're all about murder, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
somebody is
yes.
going to die, at least one person, maybe several more in a book. And that's the same thing Lee Child is writing about, and Lisa Gardner, and Jeff Deaver, and Mike Connelly. You know, we're all in the same business. But what makes us different is how our characters approach those crimes. I mean, gosh, last year Lee Child and I wrote about similar things, but we told them in such a different way because that's what our voice is. So I think the key for any writer is not so much the story or the plot, though, you know, that's also very important too. But figuring out how to express that story through characters that people want to spend time with, they want to find out what this character is going to do next. That's the difficult part.
Throughout your writing career, have you ever had a mentor?
I did my ninth grade English teacher, and she unfortunately passed away last year. But
she was
a constant in my life, and she was the first teacher I had who said, "You're really good, but you could be better." You know, I had coasted along pretty easily on writing assignments until her, and she really challenged me, and she was supportive, and she, remember, all my short stories were usually people dying at the end of horrible deaths, and she said to me, you know, you should leave some people alive in case you want to write a sequel.
That's
she
a great
was a
tip.
Very big influence for me.
You know, now having her in your life, do you advise for listeners to seek out a mentor if they don't have one?
Well, I think each person is different. I didn't realize that she really was a mentor until the last few years of my life. She was doing it in sneaky way by giving me books to read that she thought would direct me in the right. She could tell what themes I was exploring, what I was trying to do, and she would give me, you know, Marcus Aurelius or Flannery O'Connor or, you know, something like that that she thought would help open up my thinking. And she was always right about that. But, you know, I think everybody's different. Some people need that. Some people don't. Some people need more of it. I would say that, you know, don't give your work to someone who's going to love it. Give it to someone you trust to tell you it's bad and then listen to them and try to learn from that.
I know you mentioned you write in your cabin. Before that, have you ever attended workshops or retreats that you really enjoyed that has made an impact on you?
You know, I haven't. And it's great that some people have that and that it enriches them. I'm a very solitary person, very introverted. And my writing is something that I like to keep in my head. I don't like to talk about it until I'm doing it. And I think everybody has a different way of doing things. You know, some people may be like me and kind of grumpy and solitary, and other people need that feedback. And you know, I think it just depends on the individual person. What it boils down to is I think if you need that you should absolutely have it, but you should make sure that you need it, doing it because you think you should do it. Because I think that that's also another trap. I was doing an event, and someone asked me about those mind boards, you know, where you...
Mind
clouds or something, where you write down ideas.
What is that?
A board and scatter them around. And I think that can be a really great idea for the right person. It could be a really horrible idea for someone who's just going to sit there for hours and hours and hours and make the board look beautiful, but an opinion or a resolution. So I think it's great if you have a good group who can do that. But I've known some people who have been in some fairly toxic groups. And part of that is just the people who are there. You know, you need to pick people who are like-minded individuals and invested in helping you.
Yes, thank you. That was very important that you did share that and enlighten us with. What are you working on right now that you can share with the listeners? I know you have Pretty Girls out, so listeners, please check it out. And Karen, is there anything that you're working on that we should also check out?
Well, I've just finished my next book, which is called The Kept Woman. It has Will Trent, my GBI agent, who's been in many of my books, and that comes out in September. So I'm working on what's called the final pass pages, which is the last time I get to look at the book before it's printed. So that's always pretty exciting. You know, there's a panic, oh, my gosh, if I miss something, I'm going to get 1,000 letters to people. So I'm real excited about that.
Oh, gosh, congratulations.
Thank you.
So excited. So we'll definitely have to look out for that in the fall. And let us know, where can we find you on social media?
I'm on Facebook. I'm occasionally on Twitter, but not enough, apparently. But, yeah, I'm on Facebook a lot. I post a lot of cat pictures and puppy pictures. I'm sponsoring a group of puppies at Auburn University who are going to be trained to be sniffer dogs, so they're going to look for dead bodies and drugs and explosives and all that kind of thing. And the puppy, they're named after my character, so one is Will Trent and one is Sarah and Faith and Amanda.
Oh my God, I love that.
Yeah.
What breeds are they?
They're mostly yellow lab, and these are
so
fat,
cute.
Fat little puppies. Oh my God.
Oh my God.
They're
that's
just
so cute.
And I had a contest on Facebook to, you know, pick which toy to send them. Of course, I sent them all the toys. And so now we've got pictures of them playing with the toys. And They are massive, massive puppies, though. They're going to be really big dogs, but they're just adorable little sweethearts right now.
Oh, gosh, that must be so hard to try and train them. I would be so distracted petting them all day, feeding them, hanging out with them. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
well, listeners, well, please check out Karen's page. Check out these adorable puppies because I'm a huge animal lover. I love that you love dogs and cats as well. So, Karen, one last question. Let's wrap it up and let us know if there's any book or books that you love that have made an impact on your writing. I know you mentioned a few that your mentor recommended to you. Are there any other books that we can check out as well?
Well, you know, Flannery O'Connor's short stories were fantastic, and I think any writer can benefit from reading them and looking at the structure, because she always said that it's not the short part of it that makes the story, it's the story. And in a novel, you have so many pages to develop a character that maybe you're taking too many pages. And with a short story, you have a paragraph. And she was just a master at immediately distilling everything you need to know about a character into a paragraph. And I think that's a good lesson for any author.
And that wraps up our episode with Karen Slaughter. Karen, thank you so much for coming onto the show and sharing your stories and passing on your wisdom to our storytellers. And to you listeners, thank you so much for listening in and being a part of our growing community of storytellers. Check out Karen's show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Karen Slaughter. And you can say hi to Karen on Facebook at facebook.com/author Karen Slaughter. One more thing before I head out. I've been listening to your comments and feedback about wanting to publish your own work. I truly believe you'll want to hear what our sponsor has to offer, especially if you're a writer or a poet. Vermont College of Fine Arts has two writing programs I want to tell you about. Their MFA in Writing is one of the original low residency programs and, frankly, one of the best in the country. Writers gather at VCFA's beautiful campus for two separate 10-day residencies each year. Imagine yourself immersed in a setting much like an intense writer's retreat where you're fully committed to workshops, lectures, and readings. After the residencies, you return home and work with a dedicated faculty advisor throughout the rest of the semester. The MFA in Writing and Publishing is their very first and brand new residential program that also focuses on improving your writing and giving you the tools to thrive in the arts. Every student learns directly from agents, editors, and publishers. The cool thing is that it's a cross-genre program, which means if you're a poet, you're encouraged to learn from faculty in fiction or nonfiction. Imagine yourself learning and creating in this incredible writing community, all while living on their gorgeous campus in Montpelier, Vermont. Be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/VCFA to learn more about these programs and about their MFA in Writing for Children and Young Adults. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.